Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, July 19th, 2009, and this is show number 215. So, I bet you thought this whole AT&T, Apple, broken iPhone 3GS story was over, didn't you? I only had 17 phone calls so far, so we shouldn't be that naive. That can't be enough. Well, remember the part in the plot where Apple pulled the SIM card from my new and yet dead 3GS, just popped it back into my original gen iPhone so I'd be back in business while I waited for my phone? I remember thinking, oh yeah, this is going to end well. I'm sure no one needs to, call AT&T and warn them about what we're doing. Well, shockingly, things have continued to go wrong. It was actually pretty entertaining, and I have to give AT&T some chops here. They did a great job taking care of a ludicrous situation. So here's what happens next. I get my first bill, and it's pushing $400. So I'm not really thinking too clearly about that, and I'm figuring, okay, that must be the purchase of my two iPhones. But then I start thinking, shouldn't there be a cell phone bill on top of the $400? So I started poking around a little bit, and then I found a charge of $11.80 for my son's text messages. Well, I thought maybe it was my text messages at first, and I thought it was because there was a short gap between when I bought the phones off the AT&T website and when I was able to go back in and add a text messaging plan. See, they didn't actually have it set up right where I could buy the text messaging plan to start with. Well, I figured that's probably what caused the little problem, the little $11.80. So I call AT&T up, and I get a real helpful guy on the phone. I tell him the story, and he says, no problem, I'll take the $11.80 off. But then while he's working on that, I flip to the next page, and I realize that that is mine, but on Kyle's iPhone, they're charging me $189 in text messaging fees. What? So I still have my little friend on the phone, so I explain that we have yet another problem. And he gives me the line all cell phone people love to use, and that's, oh, you changed your plan mid-month, so there's some proration charges. Yeah, right. I explained very carefully to him that this conversation will not end with me ending in paying an extra $189 just because I chose to pay them an extra $400 for two iPhones. He's standing firm, as I'm sure he's instructed to do, and I just say, supervisor. So boss man comes on the phone, takes one look at the bill, and says, you know, you've been a good customer. Oh, you're a really good customer. I'm just going to knock this right off your bill. I'm not even going to look into it. I'm not going to spend any time trying to figure out what went wrong. I was delighted. You know, stuff goes wrong, and we all know computer systems have flaws, but it's all in how you're treated when things mess up that matters. So I'm good to go. Very happy. I was on the phone a total of maybe 12 minutes, which, you know, is light speed in cell phone company times. I figure I'm home free. Good to go. It's finally over. That is, until the middle of the night when we're in Vegas this week, and I get a mysterious text message on my iPhone saying, your data plan is ineligible for iPhone 3G. To prevent excess charges and enable visual voicemail, contact your telecom manager or AT&T. What? And in the middle of the night, they decide to text message me in the middle of the night about this. Oh man, I couldn't believe this. So the next day, we're on our way back from Vegas, and I figure I've got a four-hour drive. I have enough time to call a cell phone company, just barely. So I decide to give them a call. I get a hold of my little friend Esther over at AT&T, and we have a grand old laugh about all this. Just as I suspected, a slight detail was missed in transferring from the 3G to the first gen and back to the 3G. Turns out it was that pesky second change that didn't quite get done right. I was still on the 2G plan. See, I'm shocked. I'm just amazed that something goes wrong there. So anyway, after Esther gets it all fixed, she says, oh, there's going to be some proration issues. No, really? Because I'm fixing it mid-month. So I guess my words of advice to you are, keep in mind, whatever you do, there will be a proration charge, and you will spend hours and hours and hours and hours on the phone to your cell phone company. Whether it's AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, Sprint, it'll be hell on earth. Well, I have some very exciting news. This is actually fun news. I have been selected to be a speaker at the newly combined Blog World Expo and New Media Expo 2009. I'm going to be doing what I call the Podcaster Starter Kit, in which I'll walk through the tools and processes to create a podcast the way I create a podcast. I'll essentially be following along with the plot I built for Podcasting on Podcasting. I hope you can come and spend a few days in Vegas at the Expo from October 15th to 17th. Do you have a desire to create video screencasts of your desktop where you can capture the desktop, maybe include a picture-in-picture of yourself, and then publish it on the web? Well, there's a good chance you don't have unlimited funds, or perhaps you switch from a Mac to Windows to Linux, and you need an application that goes across all of those platforms without having to buy it several times. Well, I have a hot tip for you. How about a free web application that allows you to do all that? Enter ScreenToaster from ScreenToaster.com. When you go to your first go to ScreenToaster, you can start recording even without creating an account. The trick is to save your video to your hard drive or post it anywhere online, you have to create a free account. It's great because it gives you a feel for how the application works, so, you know, it's kind of a good way to get you to try it without having to do anything at all to start with. To start up a recording, go to ScreenToaster.com and you'll see a big fat Start Recording button. A progress window comes up showing that a few steps are being readied. Then you get a menu saying that ScreenToaster is ready to record, and it gives you some options of what and how to record. First, you can choose full desktop or rectangular area. I thought there'd be a window option too, but since the program isn't running natively on your machine, it probably can't know that there is a window. The next pull-down lets you choose audio options from no audio at all to each of the audio devices your machine has enabled. If you choose an audio option, the typical Adobe Flash Player settings menu comes up, requesting access to your audio and video devices, and you need to click Allow. Under the audio device chosen, there's a slider so you can adjust your input volume to the movie. I noticed that even though my system preferences were set to about 3/4 of maximum on my mic input volume, speaking into the mic didn't register much on the meter and ScreenToaster. I had to drag the slider up to 100% to get the volume up to about 3/4. So keep that in mind. Next, you can choose your webcam if you want to include picture-in-picture in your screencast. Once you choose a camera, it shows you a live preview, but oddly, the screen is kind of a strange proportion, so you look kind of squished vertically. It's a long, narrow rectangle. It's kind of a weird little screen they have there. Finally, you can open a section called Geek Settings. I love that button. Had to push that. It allows you to record from a VNC server, but that was a little geeky even for me, so I quickly closed that up. You can define the location and size of the rectangle you want to record, but I didn't see an option for the placement or size of the picture-in-picture. It does appear to favor the bottom right corner of the screen for your picture-in-picture. Well, I made a test recording showing GarageBand with picture-in-picture, even though I have yet to log in. I was able to preview my video on the ScreenToaster website. It looked pretty good, but a bit compressed on the picture-in-picture in particular. There's a full-screen mode that looked really good, except for the picture-in-picture. One morning, I noticed that the recording actually stops earlier than when you click stop. So finish what you have to say, count a few seconds out, and then hit stop to be sure you've got your full recording. Once you're done, on the right side, there's a bunch of options you can choose. You can bail right away and do a new recording. You could edit the video you just made. You can upload it to ScreenToaster in high quality or upload it to YouTube. Finally, you can save it as a .mov file to your computer or save it in a Flash SWF file, which they say is experimental. All of these options require you to log in. Unfortunately, if you just click log in like I did, it erases the video you just recorded. So instead, if you've already made a recording, click on one of the upload or download options first. The login is requested and your movie will be saved. I never did get the hang of the editing features. You're supposed to be able to add callouts on the video, for example, but every time I hit the callout button, it stopped the movie, so I'm not exactly sure how that's supposed to work. Saving your video to disk will save it as a zip file, oddly enough, because it saves both the MOV file and an FLV file, which says is the audio track. But it's not really the audio track. The second file is actually the picture-in-picture video. Again, the MOV file looks fantastic. A few artifacts here and there, but the picture-in-picture looks horrible. Huge pixels, like my face was made up of like maybe 4 entire pixels. I think I know why they did this in 2 files. Turns out you can place the picture-in-picture anywhere you want on screen using another video editing program. The only problem here is that I'm not a sophisticated user, so I don't have any tools that would allow me to do something fancy like combine 2 video tracks on top of each other. And if I were a sophisticated user, I don't think I'd be using an online service for this, especially since the picture-in-picture looks so dreadful. And I don't see that that's probably a real good fit. While I'm whining about this, the audio sounds pretty bad too. If I want to round out all of the complaints, the picture-in-picture also starts late when you start recording. It jumps into place about a full second after you start recording for some reason. But it leaves a nice white rectangle on screen to tell you something will come up eventually. So let's forget about downloading to our disk for now and look at the options for uploading. I clicked the Upload to Screen Toaster option, and in a very short time it was up online. I say short time because I started it after I started importing the version on my desktop into iMovie, and it got online at Screen Toaster faster than the one I downloaded was able to import into iMovie. I thought that was pretty amazing. Maybe that just says iMovie's really slow. I don't know. Well, once you've uploaded to one option, say like Screen Toaster or YouTube, you can't go back and upload to the second option or save to disk. I'd really like to be able to do all three, especially to compare the video, but I'm way too lazy to make multiple videos for you guys, so I'm not going to do that. I embedded the video that I hosted on Screen Toaster's website so you can see how it looks. Bottom line is that if you're on a tight budget or have relatively simple screencasting needs, Screen Toaster is a fantastic resource that lets you make screencasts on any platform. The price is right at free, and the quality of the screencast portion is very, very good. I am disappointed in both the audio and the picture-in-picture, but who really needs that talking head anyway? If you're trying to teach something, pay attention to the screen. So check out this free service at screentoaster.com. You know, one of the reasons I prefer shareware and freeware over commercial software built by huge companies is the personal touch you can get from the developers. Recently, I was corresponding with David Bogdan, who's a fan of the show and a teacher in Japan. He recently bought ScreenSteps, which for a teacher took a while to justify to himself, and I've wondered whether he felt it was worth it. I was happy to read his email on the subject, so I thought I'd read it to you too. He said, "Trevor at ScreenSteps and I were doing a lot of corresponding recently. There was trouble with the Japanese in the new annotations feature. I was doing a lot of testing on my end while he was doing a lot of fixing on his until things are now working fine. They're really into customer support there. Thanks again for introducing me to the app." Well, you know, guys, maybe I should pretend that ScreenSteps is 100% flawless, but you'd never believe that anyway. The real deal is when you get fantastic support from people who care deeply about their product and work with you till everything is working perfectly. It's clear from this unsolicited testimonial that that's what you get with ScreenSteps. Check out the best instructional documentation tool I've ever seen at ScreenSteps.com. Give the free trial a spin, and then when you have to buy it and you can't stop yourself, be sure to use the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards, all capital letters, to get 25% off. Well, Will wrote in with an interesting software review, and I think you'll enjoy it. Here's what he sent. "I just finished listening to the show before the one you did this Sunday. I would apologize for being behind, but that's the point of this time-shifted content, so I guess I won't apologize. In that show, you were talking about the green button that's supposed to zoom a window on the Mac. I, too, find this annoying because it doesn't always do it, but since I didn't have a podcast to complain about, I went on and found a solution. Right Zoom, that's RightZoom, from Blazing Tools Software at blazingtools.com, exists to solve this problem. The makers of it seem to be focused on making the Mac more like Windows. They even have a Shutter Start Menu app, but they can be temporarily forgiven. Right Zoom runs in the background with no dock or menu bar icon, and you have to manually add it to your login items. The first time you launch it, hold down the Command key so you can configure the preferences. Because you've probably downloaded it and clicked it a few times and won't bother to read the manual, I should probably tell you that this only works if it's not running already, so you'll have to quit it in Activity Monitor first." Well, Will sure knows me, right? He knows I'm not going to read the manual, I'm just going to start clicking everything. He sent in a screenshot of how he has it set up, suggesting that I poke around with the settings at this point, since it seems to be what I do best. I downloaded and installed RightZoom, even though I got a little bit of a chilly feeling down my spine when I read that Blazing Tools also makes keylogger software for the Mac. Yikes! I did a bit of fooling around, and I found that indeed it does maximize Windows with the green button just like they said. It's pretty cool that it lets you finally use the green button like it seems it should always have worked. They have a keystroke option too. You can use Command Option E to enable full screen on Windows. It's on any window you have. It really, really works well. Well, thanks, Will. You did find a great solution, and I'll have to think about adding yet another startup item to my machine. It already takes about 23 minutes for me to boot up because of all the slopola I load on boot. Well, I bet many of you are constantly wondering, what can I do to help the NoSilicast podcast? I get so much geeky goodness, I just wish I knew how to give back. Now, an awful lot of you have given back, but I wanted to let everyone else know what they can do to support the show. First of all, there's email. I love getting encouraging emails and even those with constructive criticism. The key word is here, of course, constructive. Dumb questions are ideal. That gives me meat for the show and helps so many people. Don't be shy. I've yet to mock anyone. Well, except for crazy listener James, but that's a whole other story. Recording of reviews are another great way to give back. You don't have to be brilliant, but it does help. What you do have to do is keep it in the 3 to 5 minute range and make sure your audio is pretty good. You don't have to go out and get a high LPR 40 or anything, but a lot of hiss or buzz and it might get rejected. If a product review isn't up your alley, how about a Honda Bob ad? We've had some brilliant ones, maybe too good because they're hard to live up to, but give it a shot anyway. The instructions are on the right sidebar on podfeet.com under Honda Bob Fun. How about joining us in the chat room on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. GMT 9-8 at ustream.tv/nosilicast? That's a lot of fun, and I get a lot of good show ideas from there, and it really pumps me up to have a live audience, even if they've gone off the deep end and started talking about Star Trek or something while I was talking. Check it out. They're very welcoming in there, I promise. Well, maybe you're shy. You don't feel like putting yourself out there. How about helping the show financially? It does cost money to create the show, so there's a helpful PayPal donation button right there on podfeet.com. You just push it. Push the button. And, throw a few bucks towards bandwidth and hosting fees. That would be great. Well, maybe you don't have cash handy for donations, but you do buy stuff online. How about searching for what you want using my Amazon affiliate link in the right sidebar? There's a handy little search window, and whatever you buy at Amazon, after you click there, a small percentage comes back to help the show. It's an easy way to help where it doesn't cost you a dime, but it helps me out. Another way to help the show is to write an iTunes review. There's a bunch of great ones out there already, and you can only write one, so if you've already done it, thank you. I've heard it helps in the rankings if you get a lot of reviews, and higher rankings make it more likely for the show to be found, which means more people listening, which makes me happy. You know what? The trick is, I don't think they even have to be good reviews. You just have to have lots of them. And finally, the reason I'm bringing all of this up, by popular demand, mostly from the lunatics in the chat room from the live show, I have opened a storefront where you can buy NoSilicast logo wear. Yes, you can buy shirts and be a walking advertisement for the show. How cool is that? Again, I get a percentage to go towards the cost of the show, and you get a cool shirt. What? You've got a baby and a toddler? There's shirts for them too, Mac Mommy. Got a puppy? There's clothes for them too. You work in an office? How about a nice wall clock with the NoSilicast logo? Like to barbecue? How about an apron? What about Mac Trucker and Truck Lover? Yep, there's trucker hats. Okay, maybe you're a little more sensitive. There's even a cute little teddy bear with the NoSilicast logo on it. It's really cute. Anyway, no matter what your taste, there's a NoSilicast logo item for you too. Head on over to cafepress.com/NoSilicast and be the first on your block to have a nice NoSilicast logo wear item. Well, Pam and Cecilia were at Honda Bob's 30th anniversary picnics, and they have some opinions on Honda Bob's performance as a mechanic extraordinaire. So now I'm disturbing Pam and Cecilia, and I just wanted to ask them, I turned the microphone on and scared you to death, you were talking about how many jams he'd gotten you out of.
Yes, he has. I mean, when the car just died, he told me what to do. We got right down, get yourself a new battery, drive yourself on over and replace it, and then the car is right on its way.
Wow, so that was not even a case where he came to you. You just knew you could call him on the phone and he'd help you out, right?
Absolutely. And he's taken lint out of my dryer. He's on cabinets for me. And assisted his wife with her bird's nest collections.
Oh, my gosh. You guys do know. You know, I'm learning all these things. One guy said he's tricked him into babysitting his children. He was there taking care of the car, so he left him with his kids.
Well, this guy is too easy, I think.
I think so. Now, Cecilia, does he work on your cars as well?
Yes, he does. I live in a... I share an alley with Pam.
So, oh, okay.
That's how I came to know about Honda Bob, that, you know, she had this man in her garage that I would talk to.
Ooh, a man in her garage.
And then, I thought, I need to get a Honda because it's so easy. He just comes to your house and fixes. You could still, you know, clean the house or do your, you know, just sit somewhere in some little room.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine? I wonder how many people have bought Hondas because of Honda Bob. Sounds like you did.
I did. I did. I'm not sorry, though. It's a great car. I have a hybrid. It's great.
You like it. Is that the Civic hybrid or
the Civic hybrid?
Oh,
yeah.
Nice. Those are good looking cars too.
They are nice, and they're speedy little things too.
I can tell you another story.
Oh, good. Go for it.
My son-in-law is a national manager for Toyota, but I will not buy a Toyota because I won't get Honda Bob.
Oh my goodness! Oh dear, we better not tell him. Well, thank you both of you. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Well, if I haven't convinced you by now that you should call Honda Bob if you live in the LA or Orange County areas and you own a Honda and an Acura, maybe you'll listen to Pam and Cecilia. Heck, he'll come over and clean your dryer lint, evidently. Give him a call at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. It's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz for BartB.ie. How are you this lovely Saturday night, Bart?
I'm not sure it's that lovely, and I'm feeling pretty cranky today, but I'll cheer up now that I'm talking to you. Always cheers me up.
There you go. It's always fun for me, especially when we can start off with some security light. Looks like we got a lot on the ticket today.
We do. Some good news, some not so good news. So last Tuesday was Microsoft Patch Tuesday, so remember to patch all of your Windows machines and don't forget about those poor virtual machines. Boot them up, patch them, put them back to sleep again. The good news is that you may remember we talked about an ActiveX flaw last week.
Right.
That is patched.
Oh, good. That's pretty quick.
Yeah, we don't know how old the bug was, but it went 0 day last week, so it was pretty quick of them.
But for Apple, I mean, that'd be another 3 months or something till Apple would fix it, right?
It depends. They're sometimes quick on their own things. They're just not good on the third-party stuff.
Ah, I got it. So I've always wondered, I've got Windows 7 running under a couple of VMs, but mm-hmm. I don't think these Patch Tuesday things affect those release candidate VM or Windows 7 things.
I don't really know. It may just be a case you can't secure a pre-release version of Windows. I'm not really sure how that works.
Okay.
So I don't know if these bugs just don't affect it or if they're just not pushing out updates, but it's one of the things that makes me a little worried about running an operating system that doesn't officially exist yet.
Yeah, there is that. Talk about living on the edge, right?
The bleeding edge.
All right. What else we got?
Very similarly, I wrote in the show notes, deja vu all over again. We have another 0 day exploit in Microsoft's products. And again, it's an ActiveX control, only it's not the same control. It's now a control for Microsoft Office Web Components. It again allows remote code execution. Anyone who has Microsoft Office installed on Windows is vulnerable. If you don't have Office installed, you're not vulnerable.
So if you're running OpenOffice, you're okay?
Well, it doesn't matter what you use. It matters what you have installed.
Oh, really? Oh, it's just what's installed. Yikes.
Yeah, so when you install Office, it installs this component.
And is it for all versions of Microsoft Office on Windows?
From what I can tell, yes.
Oh, wow. Okay. So what's the solution to that?
Just like last week, there's a little fix-it button on Microsoft web page that we have linked in the show notes. So it's the same idea, it just flips the kill bit for this component instead of last week's component.
This is fun. We get to flip a bit every week.
you can flip back the one from last week if you flipped it.
Except, of course, we decided we don't really care. Whatever that thing was running, it didn't really matter, right?
To be honest, I don't think it matters. So I actually personally, if I were running Windows, I wouldn't be flipping back the bit. I'd just leave it there. but for this one, you probably do want to flip it back later.
Okay, so again, for the audience, what Bart's talking about is we've just got a link to in the show notes. There's a big button that says fix it, and you push it. That's all you have to do.
Yeah,
so that's kind of cool. I like the way they're doing that. That's great. All right. And that's it?
No.
please don't
so
tell
far,
me about
it's
the
been
last
old
one.
Windows, but now we get to do one of those ones where everyone gets to play along.
Oh, I was feeling left out.
Yeah, and our favorite browser, Firefox, there is a remote code execution vulnerability. It's only in Firefox 3.5, not in the latest version of Firefox 3.0.
Oh.
But it's a pretty serious one, remote code execution, the usual kind of carry on. There is no patch at the moment. There are some workarounds, and Mozilla are working on a patch, so expect a patch soon.
So how do you get stung with this one?
It's JavaScript. They've added something called a just-in-time compiler to JavaScript in Firefox 3.5, which has the effect of speeding up the execution of JavaScript quite a bit, thereby making the whole browser nippier than its compatriots.
Okay.
So technically it's a good thing. Unfortunately, it's a brand new feature and they seem to have made a slight boo-boo in the implementation.
Aww.
So you need to either use something like NoScript and simply not run JavaScript with the exception of sites you trust, or the other alternative is there's a the Mozilla security blog have instructions for disabling the just-in-time compiler part of JavaScript without disabling JavaScript.
Oh.
So that will, if you flip that, it's a bit, only it's not quite a kill bit, it's slightly different. Firefox has a whole bunch of hidden under-the-hood options that normally humans don't get to play with. But if you type about :config into the address bar, it shows you all of these hidden settings, and you just need to turn one of those off.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
And, of course, remember to turn it back on. So, again, it's very similar to a kill bit, only it's a kill option.
I like what it says when you type in about :config. It says, this might void your warranty.
What warranty? It's free.
Changing these advanced settings can be harmful to the stability, security, and performance of this application. You should only work if you're sure you know what you're doing. And the button says, I'll be careful, I promise.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I don't usually poke around in there, but there's a lot in there. So there's a search bar, thankfully, so you can actually find what you want pretty quickly. And the instructions tell you what to type into the search bar, and it'll narrow down the options pretty quick. And then literally you just flick something from true to false. So basically there's an option in there that says use this just-in-time compiler, or JIT.
Oh, wow.
And you turn that from on to off. And then whenever they do release the patch, remember to go in there and turn it from off back to on, otherwise you'll be stuck on a slow Firefox instead of a fast Firefox.
Wow, I've already done it. I typed about:config, said, yes, I'll be careful, I promise. Type JIT, J-I-T, in the filter box. Double-click the JavaScript options JIT content button thingy and change it to false.
There you go, you're safe.
Wow, that's better than turning on that NoScript thing that drives me crazy, Bart.
Yeah, see, the thing is, I have the NoScript thing on already, so I didn't bother with flipping the switch. I prefer to have no JavaScript anywhere, but wherever I do have it, I want it fast.
There you go. Well, cool. All right, is that it now?
That's it for security.
Whew, that's good. Well, I wanted to take us down a path we've kind of glanced around from time to time, but I don't ever think we've done a deep dive, is I get a lot of comments from people, lots of email. I don't know why they don't write to you, but they write to me about how great your photos are. And so I thought it might be kind of fun to walk through the process you go through from taking your photographs to the barting of the photos and all the editing that you do and where you put them up and just, you know, what that whole process is, because you do come out with some extraordinary shots.
Thank you. You can't see me blush, but trust me, I am.
Well, it's not me saying it, it's everybody else, so that's okay.
That doesn't make it any difference. I'm still blushing.
Good.
It's still very nice, and I do appreciate it when people take the time to, you know, let me know that my photos aren't crap, which is always good. Although, of course, what you see is only the teeniest, tiniest tip of the iceberg, so many of them are crap.
Well, and that's probably part of the point here, right?
Yeah, pretty much. The more photos you take, the more chances you have of taking a good one. So take lots of pictures. That's one of the gifts digital photography has given us. You can be really trigger happy with that shutter release, and it's not going to cost you an arm and a leg. I used to shoot film, and when I was a kid, my parents used to always give up to me. It's like, what do you mean you've gone through 36 exposures already? I was just having fun. It's like, I'm not buying you any. You're not getting any more film till next week.
It's So you've been like this for birth, huh?
Yeah, pretty much. I was an Olympus OM-1 was my first proper camera, and I had great fun with that. But I went through a lot of film, and it cost quite a bit of money. I think actually at one stage I got an agreement with my local photo place that they wouldn't print the prints; they'd only develop the roll and then give me back the roll as a developed negative. I'd scan through it and then say, "Give me, you know, photos 4, 7, and 9, please."
Oh, because it would have cost you a fortune to develop everything you took.
Well, yeah, to print everything, and most of them wouldn't have been worth printing. So it was nice of them. I got to know the guy who ran the shop pretty well. So I'd say, Ray, you know, I don't actually want them all printed. Just develop this and let me have a look, and then I'll tell you what I want printed, if any.
Okay. So what do you do now?
Yeah, I just take loads and loads of pictures because it's digital. Yay! Yeah, so my advice is, you know, whenever you find an interesting subject, take lots of pictures. Get high, get low, try from the left, try from the right, try, you know, with the light coming at you, try with the light at your back, try it from every side, every angle, different focal length, different apertures. Just keep trying. Try lots of different things. You know, it's digital, it's free, so experiment. Hmm. And the result will be that you come home with a lot of photographs. Very lot of photographs. And so that's where the work then comes in. So I run all my stuff through Aperture, and I use that for my entire workflow pretty much. So I start off, I suck it into Aperture, and then I do one very quick pass through all of the photographs from that day, and I just nuke anything that just completely and utterly did not work. So if it's out of focus, no matter how cool it is, apart from the fact that it's out of focus, it just gets binned, because there's no way you can, you can't compensate for bad focus. You just can't fix that in post, so bin it. And bin it quickly before you spend too much time going, oh, I really wish that had worked. And
then, you know, that's what I do. I get attached to them like they're my children or something. You know?
Yeah, that's why I'm pretty ruthless first time through and just nuke like mad. If it isn't in focus, if it's madly over or madly underexposed, just throw it in the bin.
Okay.
So then, I go through quite a few passes. So that's pass number one. Then the second pass, you go through them all a little more carefully. And usually I will have, you know, I'll find something of interest and I will have taken lots of photographs of it from all different angles and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I will go through each subject and just pick the ones that worked and the ones that didn't work and keep maybe 2 or 3. I'll pick my favorite, which I'll give 4 stars, and I'll give the others 3 stars and I'll delete the rest. So I could have started off with 10 and I'll be left with 2 or 3 at this stage.
Now, I actually read a book on Aperture, which I know will shock everyone in the audience that I read a book. But they explained a way in Aperture where you can bring up, if you've got 4 or 5 pictures of the same thing, you can bring up one as the like the reference photo, and then you can flip through the other ones so you can be going, you know, better or worse, better or worse, better or worse kind of thing. Do you use that?
I don't, because I like to get them actually full screen.
Okay, well, so but if you're comparing
if you have two of them, not quite full screen.
Oh, okay, so you're flipping just A, B, A, B, A, B, back and
I'm
forth.
I'm going, yeah, okay. I compare the two next to each other and delete or keep, and then compare the two next to each other, delete or keep, and sort of go like that.
Okay.
But I tend to use the loop a lot, so I tend to be hitting the tilde key quite a bit to bring up the loop so that I can, you know, really see whether it is or isn't sharp, because you can't really tell whether, you know, if you have a camera with a couple of megapixels, you have way less pixels on your screen than the camera has pixels. So if you don't use that loop to see it at 100%, you actually don't know whether or not it's sharp.
Right, right. Well, that's the big danger. How many times have you looked in the viewfinder and said, oh my God, that picture was amazing, and then you get home and it's crap because you couldn't see it was out of focus?
Yeah, well, actually, I've gotten into the habit of using the zoom function very heavily on the back of the Nikon.
Yeah.
And I'll just zoom in on any random part, but just to make sure it's actually in focus.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so now you've got it down to, say, 3 or 4?
Of every subject. So at that point, I will actually go and I will edit all of those 3 or 4.
Hmm.
And so my editing process is, I call it sort of, you know, a whole collection of subtle tweaks. And generally speaking, subtle is a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that you do particularly dramatic editing. You just subtly tweak everything so that it's as good as it can be. I usually start off with getting the exposure bang on right. So first off, if there's any blown, there's an option in Aperture to show you what they call hot and cold areas. They're basically overexposed and underexposed areas in the shot. And I always turn that on so that I can see at a glance. Okay, those highlights are blown out. I've lost detail here.
What's that feature called?
I think it's called Highlight Hot and Cold Areas. It's in View.
Oh, okay. I've never played with that. Oh, yeah. Highlight hot and cold areas. Oh, how interesting. So that tells you when you've got a picture that's blown out?
Well, it will show you the bits of the picture that are blown out. So anything blown out goes red, and anything where there isn't enough light goes blue. So hot and cold.
Okay.
So my first step is to get rid of all the red and the blue. So you get rid of the red by using the recovery slider, and you get rid of the blue by using the black point slider and just pulling it back to the left.
Oh.
Because the black point is in the middle slider. It's a slider that starts almost at the left, but not quite. And so you use the black point to just pull it back until you have everything in there. You've pulled out all the detail you can at that stage. If there's no blown highlights or no shadows, I will use the black point slider in the other direction, right until the point where I get a spot of blue, and then just back off a smidge.
Oh, that's a great idea. I like that.
And you do the same with the white point, but there's no white point slider. You have to use the very end adjustment-y thing on the levels brick.
Right.
Which is your white point slider, but it's not a traditional slider like the black point one is. And so if you do that, you use that one until you just get nothing blown out, and use the other one until you just get nothing, then you have the perfect, you know, your whole exposure is perfect. You have your blacks are pure black and your whites are pure white. Nothing's blown out, and you have all of the information in there to play with. And that tends to give you images that look much richer, much more contrasty. The colors will come out a lot better because the exposure is simply right.
Hmm. See, I've always just been grabbing the exposure thing and dragging it around going, I don't know what this thing's doing, and it's going from good to bad to worse. But I never thought about having those, the hot and cold.
Will really help you see when you're done.
Yeah, that is
Then once you have that done, you have all the information is now in the photo and there's nothing blown out or drowned out, but it still may not look very good. So the next thing to do is to take the midpoint slider and get the midpoint to where the picture simply looks its best.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if you want to introduce a bit of contrast, a nice way to do that is to brighten the midtones and pull back the shadow slider. So in the levels adjustment brick, you normally only have three sliders, but there's an option to give you five.
And I think I actually showed you that.
You did show me that, and it's a very good option.
Because I read the book.
I think you got that from that video podcast you put me onto.
Oh, okay. Maybe that was it. Yeah.
But yeah, so what gives you the black point on the far left, it gives you the white point on the far right, it gives you the midtones in the middle, and then you have the two additional sliders, which are basically your highlights and your shadows.
Hmm.
They're quarter tones, they're called. And so if you darken the shadow quarter tone and lighten the midtones, you get a boost in contrast, which is generally actually gives better results than using the contrast slider.
Yeah, I don't like the contrast slider at all. That just seems lazy.
Yeah, it doesn't work particularly well. I never use the contrast slider ever. So I get it looking pretty good by using the midtones and the shadow slider. And then to give the final tweak, the definition slider can help you, because what that does is it's selective contrast. It only adds contrast in edges.
The definition is, it almost feels like an unsharp mask, except not crappy and making it look horrible.
Well, no, what it actually does is it increases contrast at boundaries.
Oh, that's what it's doing.
Selective contrast. That's
okay.
What it's doing. And it really helps to make the different elements in your photographs differentiate themselves from each other.
So do you use definition on a lot of photos?
I use a small amount of definition on just about them all.
Oh.
You can get carried away. I tend to use about 5 or 7.
Huh.
So it's a scale, I think, that goes up to 100, and I tend to use about 5 or 7.
Actually, I think it goes to 1, but yeah. So it's a percentage.
I mean, 0.5 and 0.7 or something. But yeah, it's small, subtle. Subtle is the key to that one. Then the other subtle adjustment that I like to use, although I use about twice as much of it as I do of the definition, is the vibrancy.
Yeah.
Now, once you've adjusted
your... Yeah, you've got to be careful with that one.
yeah. Especially if there's greens and reds in the shot. They tend to really go completely unbelievable. But it's... If you get your exposure right, the colors tend to pop pretty well anyway. But just to give them that little extra little bit of punch, because I like my pictures to have plenty of punch. So I just give it a little bit of vibrancy just to make them really jump out at you. And at that stage, that's usually it. If it's a macro shot, I will very often put in a subtle vignette. Just subtle.
Oh.
Subtle is the key again. Because it helps. Usually, if you're taking macro, the background can be a bit distracting. So if you can help push it a little closer to black while keeping your subject at the same level, it can really make a very big difference.
Is there an actual vignette button in or brick or anything in Aperture?
There is. It's Control V will bring up the brick, or you can use the drop down to get to the brick.
Control V. Oh, look at
Control
that.
V. I know it as Control V because I use it so much.
Press return or space to paste, escape to cancel. That must not be the right thing.
Okay. Well, what? So if you bring up the adjustments.
Yeah.
Now, I'm always using the heads up display version of the adjustments.
Ah, okay.
I don't know if that makes a difference, but then if I do, yeah, it's Control V. brings up the vignette block. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
So that can often help with a micro shot, but you have to be subtle. Then sometimes, even if you've done all this, the shot still isn't great. I tend to use Dodge and Burn quite often, the Dodge and Burn plugin, because it really helps you to separate your subject from the background by brightening the subject a little and darkening everything else a little. You can also do selective contrast with that, which can be helpful, and also selective saturation. So wow. If you're, you know, your vibrancy is starting to turn your greens horrific, but you still want a bit more saturation on maybe a butterfly or something, you can use Dodge and Burn to selectively saturate just the butterfly. And also it's a selective sharpening, which can be very good.
Hmm.
Because you may not want to sharpen the background. Particularly if it's some sort of macro shot, you really don't want to be sharpening the background, which you've tried to make out of focus, and then when you try to sharpen something that's not sharp, it gets all icky looking. But you may want to sharpen the details in the wing of the butterfly or whatever. So by painting in selective sharpening, you can really make a photograph pop a little more. I really do use the Dodge and Burn plugin quite a bit these days. But you have to do that last, because that's a destructive step.
Oh, now, you said you're referring to a plugin.
Yes.
Is that something you
buy? It's
one
that comes free with Aperture.
Oh.
You get one plugin for free.
I did not know that.
So if you go to Images and Edit With, Dodge and Burn is always there.
Ah, okay.
So it's very useful.
Yeah, Dodge and Burn.
But what it does is it generates a TIFF from your current version, brings that TIFF into Dodge and Burn, and then Dodge and Burn is editing that TIFF, and then it spits back out a TIFF, which comes in as a separate version.
Okay.
But it's all being done as a TIFF, so any adjustments to exposure and stuff that you want to do to make use of all that extra information in your RAW, you have to do that first, because you're not going to have that information available to you inside the Dodge and Burn plugin.
Hmm. How do you kill... I probably shouldn't have started playing this with this during the show, but I just brought up the Dodge and Burn to see what it was. Yeah, how do you cancel it?
It's down at the bottom right, next to Save, there's Cancel.
There we go. Because it brings up a window, only closing the window is not one of the buttons you get. It's a grayed out.
No, it's one of those modal windows.
Okay, there we go.
Yeah, so in there you have a drop-down menu, which allows you to specify what you want to do. You can change the size of your brush. You can change how sort of heavily the effect is applied. And you can change the softness of the edges of the brush. And you want to keep that pretty soft. And so you just use that to paint in the adjustment you want on the bits you want.
Okay.
Again, subtle is important here. Otherwise, You can really get carried away.
Right.
So the other thing I sometimes do is I'll tone map a shot. So if you're shooting at dusk or something, even when you do all your exposure tweaks, it still isn't going to look particularly good. And tone mapping can really help where you have a high dynamic range. So sunset shots can really benefit from tone mapping. So you just tone map the single RAW.
I'm so glad you brought this up, because I was going to give you a hard time and I forgot to. I was reading on your blog about how you created a certain photo, and I was all excited about it, and I got down to where you said, okay, and then I tone mapped it, and then you went right on. What is tone mapping? I don't even know what that is. Never even heard of it.
Okay. You remember when we talked ad nauseum about HDR?
Yes.
Well, HDR has two steps. First step is to build multiple images into one image with a very high dynamic range, and step two is to tone map it so we can see that high dynamic range.
But what's tone mapping?
Okay, it's you need to in order to tone map, you need an image that has more information than you can see, which a RAW file does. A RAW file contains all the information for a shot about 1.5 stops up and 1.5 stops down. So you have a dynamic range there of about 3 stops in the RAW file, and you're seeing one slice out of it. So with tone mapping, what you do is you basically, so in different bits of the image, so maybe in the sky, which is quite bright, you use the brighter bits of the image, and in the shadows, which are quite, sorry, you use the darker bits of the image, and in the shadows, you use the brighter bits of the image, and you combine it all into one image.
Right.
So everything is properly exposed.
Right.
And nothing is under or overexposed.
Okay. So what part of that was tone mapping? Oh, okay. So...
To tone map, you need an image with more dynamic range than you can currently see, but a RAW file... is such an image. So you can tone map a RAW.
Okay, so do you go around specific areas saying use the bright part here, use the dark part there?
No, it's an algorithm. So it's Photomatix has a whole bunch of sliders inside it, but Photomatix Pro is what I use for tone mapping.
So you're using Photomatix on a RAW photo that's not multiple images?
Yes, because it effectively is multiple images, because a RAW file contains extra data.
Right. Hmm.
Now, it'll only get you plus or minus 1.5, whereas if you're actually making HDR, you may go plus or minus a hell of a lot more than that.
So each photo takes you 2.5 hours?
No, not really, no. But it does take a while. If they go as far as tone mapping, they're going to take time, because tone mapping is time consuming, because it's very easy to end up with something that looks like a cartoon instead of a photograph. And I pride myself on having realistic looking HDRs or tone mapped images.
Yeah.
And sometimes, very, very rarely, I have a copy of Pixelmator as well, and sometimes I may just have to take a photo into Pixelmator if I need to do some layers based editing on it. But that's like 0.01% of my photographs ever end up in Photomatic or in Pixelmator.
Okay. So, how do you know which photos you need to take into there?
We're not finished my passive. Okay, well, if you're not happy with them after you've done all the tweaks that Aperture allows, then you'd take them a step further.
Okay.
So sometimes you know that pretty early in. Sometimes you get as far as doing the exposure tweaks and you say, this just isn't happening. At that point, you can go straight to tone mapping or straight to Pixelmator if you want. Or maybe even straight to dodge and burn. But, you know, you need to do those exposure adjustments first so you can see what you have. And at that stage, you'll know whether there's something here or not.
Okay.
So at that stage, we're done with the editing of all the photographs. So then the fourth pass is everything gets keyworded. Everything gets keyworded. And if I'm taking nature photos, this step also includes me getting out my reference books and stuff and finding out the Latin name of the various flowers, butterflies, and other bits and bobs. And using those as keywords.
Okay.
I'm very meticulous about that. If I'm going to stick something up on Flickr, I want to be able to say, this is not just a flower, but this is this particular flower. Here's its Latin name. I'm a bit weird like that, but to me, that's very important.
Okay. I like to know people like you who know stuff like that. I will never know stuff like that.
Yeah, well, as I say, I'm sort of documenting Irish nature. So if you want to do a decent job of documenting, you need to know what you have.
Right, that makes sense.
It also helps you know if you found something special. I recently came across, I took a photo of something called a hummingbird hawk moth, which is this bizarre little insect that isn't native to Ireland at all, but when the summer is good enough, they can fly over the channel from England.
Oh, really?
And so we get them for a couple of months. They're migrants. And then when the winter comes, they die. But if the summer's poor, then we don't get them at all. But I got one this summer. I'd never seen one before in my life. I had no idea what it was. It took me quite a while to look it up because it's not really native. I was looking it up on my usual list of native Irish things. It wasn't there. But I came across it on Flickr on one of the pools I'm in. Someone else had gotten a picture of one as well. And then I was able to get the Latin name from them. And then I was able to find out that, oh, they do come to Ireland, but they only migrate here.
Cool.
But they're very cool.
Very cool. You'll have to put a link in the show notes to that picture.
Okie dokie, I can do that.
I want to see that.
It's actually not a great picture, but it was good enough. So I stuck it up anyway, because it was something special.
So on the keywording, now I use keywording since the focus of my photographs is usually people. Is my keywords tend to be people's names, so that I can say, okay, give me a smart album with all the pictures of Kyle for this, that, or the other thing.
Sure.
Do you use the heads up display keyword viewer thing, or do you use the built-in? How do you do it?
I keyword with my images in the thumbnail view. And then I select all the images that the certain keyword applies to and then drop the keyword onto them.
So I was having a terrible time with that on Aperture, and I finally, because I couldn't do it. I could only add a keyword to one image at a time, and it was driving me nuts. And it turned, and finally I wrote to Debbie T, and she couldn't figure it out of splashofstyle.com, and she's my, when all else fails, she always knows the answer, and she said, I don't know what you're talking about, works for me, and we went, and she wrote down all the steps. In fact, I think she did a screen steps for me showing exactly how it works, and it didn't work. Turned out there are five buttons down on the bottom right below the image, and one of them has a little one on it. And if you click that, it means only apply things to one image.
Oh, that's what that does.
Yeah. So that was clicked in my case, and I don't know how. I was probably just clicking buttons. You know how I am. And so I could never use that thing, so I would have to keyword to it over and over and over again. It drive me crazy.
You can use the lift and drop or
lift and stamp?
Lift and stamp tools keyword.
Okay,
but anyway.
I would have had to have done it one at a time. Well, that lifts and stamps everything, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, so if you had a couple that were the same, at least you wouldn't have to duplicate yourself.
But if you had, it lifts and stamps the all the color correction and gamma,
kind
of stuff.
Oh, no, you can remove stuff. If you click on lift, it'll have a whole bunch of stuff there. You can uncheck the adjustments and leave only keywords behind.
Okay.
And then you could even click on a keyword and click the backspace key and it won't get lifted.
Okay. It's
you can also
easier.
Do that with adjustments, by the way. So you can select the adjustments and use the backspace key to delete all the adjustments except for the ones you want to stamp.
Oh, okay.
It's not obvious, but you can do it. That's a trick I learned on a video podcast somewhere.
Cool.
So if you only want to take the crop, you can just you can click the triangle next to adjustments and delete everything but the crop and then stamp that crop on another version.
I thought you were saying crap. So just lift and stamp the
no,
crap.
No, crop. I'm fond of the word crap. I use it quite a bit, but not in this case.
All right, cool. Okay. So now you've got the Latin names on there.
Yes, so all keyworded. Then the fifth pass is geotagged a lot using MapReacher Pro.
Ah.
Then the the sixth version is to stick on quick preview mode and go through all the images one by one and rate them from 1 to 5.
Huh. Why?
So because that, okay, I am a big believer in the rating them. And then you can do things like show only the 3-star or better images or only the 5-star or better images. Sorry, 4-star or better or only the 5-star images. And when I go to do my photo of the week, it's only the 5 stars that come into consideration. So I just set my display thingy to only show me 5-star images.
But early on, you said that you rated them 4s and 3s.
Yep. And so, then the 5 stars come at the very end.
But how do you get any ones?
You look over the whole lot and you pick your favorite 1 or 2 and they get to be 5 stars.
Okay, but you said 1 to 5, but you've really only got 3, 4, and 5. Because you got rid of the 1s and 2s, right?
2 and 1. Sometimes I'll keep a 2 and 1. If I do multiple, if I'm tone mapping something, for example, I'll keep the original.
Oh, okay.
But and the chances are it will have a pretty poor rank.
Oh, okay.
Because I went to bother tone mapping it, so it will probably be a 2 or a 1.
Oh,
and sometimes I'll just take photographs of like a sign, just so that I know how to spell a place name or whatever.
Right,
and I'll
right.
keep them, but I'll give them a 1.
Okay.
So 1 star means this is only being kept because it tells me some information. 2 stars are probably images that have been in some other way edited externally, but I'm keeping the original. And then the 3s, 4s, and 5s are actual images.
Ah, okay, got you. I can buy
and
that.
And most of them will be 3 or 4, or else they'll have been deleted. And very few of them get to be 5.
Wow, this is a complicated complicated process.
It is, but once you've all this done, then usually what happens is all the 4s and 5s go on Flickr and the rest don't.
Okay.
So that's what it all boils down to.
So that would explain why your final photo, the photos we see is like, man, he's just brilliant.
Yeah, oftentimes I will start off with maybe 200 photographs from an afternoon out with the camera, because like I say, I take a lot, and maybe 4 of those will make it onto Flickr, maybe 5 or 6.
Wow.
So that gives you an idea of how many of them get binned or don't make it to 4 or 5 stars.
Well, I'm glad to know you do keep some photos, though, just because that are still
maybe
ones. Yeah,
the trees get to stay, but they don't get to go to Flickr. obviously, the next very important step is run it back up.
Ah.
You just spent quite a significant amount of time and effort here, so you should run it back up. In my case, that means I just sync it with my home aperture vault.
Yeah. Now, I don't do that vault thing.
I do. I like vaults because it means I get to control the backup of just my photographs separately from everything else.
Ah, okay.
So I don't have to run a full system backup to make sure my photos are safe. I just stick them in the vault.
Oh, that's what it's for.
And you can also have multiple vaults. So I have a vault in work and I have a vault at home.
Okay.
So on Mondays, usually I'll sync the vault in work.
So that's for your offsite backup?
That's the offsite. Actually, often Monday and Friday.
Oh, okay. Twice a week.
Yeah, it doesn't always work out that way, but definitely every Monday, because the chances are if there's a weekend has been and gone, I have done something with photographs.
Right, right.
So it's time to back them up.
That's why I do mine on Mondays.
Yeah, it's a good time, because weekends are when you're most productive.
Yeah, I have thought about it, though, with my my feeder backup, which is all my show notes for the podcast. Those don't get backed up until after I've already done the show. And the most catastrophic time to lose it is actually before I do the show.
That's a good point.
I do need a... I'm still working on a
time
way to
machine
do
some, doesn't take those, no?
I don't do time machine.
Oh.
Time machine's crap.
Yeah, time machine's... Oh, no. Time machine's great for the as-you-go sort of stuff.
Time machine's crap. It always fails. I don't know anybody who's ever used it that hasn't had it fail, and then they have to spend a bunch of time fooling around trying to get it started again. It just stops.
You know me.
It has never stopped working. It has always worked every single time.
I have it on all 3 of my Macs. It has never given me 1 ounce of trouble on any of them.
I've had all kinds of trouble with where I've set it up for my mother-in-law, and she'll just call me up and say, it stopped, and I have to spend 15, 20 minutes trying to figure out what made it stop this time. It just stops going. You've gotten lucky, because I'm not just measuring that against my own experience. I've talked to a lot of people where it's just like, yeah, I don't know, it just stopped. You can get it started again, but it just stops.
I have had the odd time where I'll just say backup failed and I go, oh, whatever, and I ignore it.
Yeah.
But it always picked up again an hour later.
Yeah, no, this is where it just doesn't go anymore. It literally just stops working, and it's unclear what made it stop. We've had to, you know, pull her drive out or remove her external drive and play with it and yell at it and stuff, and eventually it starts working. So
okay, I know there was a lot of trouble at first with people doing it over the air.
Yeah, no, this
I know that was really bad.
This is a USB-attached hard drive.
I do mine over... Actually, no, mine are all over FireWire. No. One of them is over USB. Hmm. Actually, I have one over USB, one over FireWire, and one of them's an internal drive. And I have no trouble on any of them.
Hmm. Well, the other thing is I'm not attached to a drive most of the time anyway. I'm mobile at all times, so...
Oh, no, I only let Time Machine... with the exception of at work where it's an internal drive, I usually only let Time Machine go once or twice a day.
Hmm.
So I keep the hard drive turned off so it doesn't wear out too much.
Remember, I also have the problem of the fact that I create a couple of gig of files a week. So if you have something like Time Machine running, it runs out of hard disk space in about a day.
Yeah, well, see, that's where I have a temp folder where I do all that kind of big stuff. Mm-hmm. And I have Time Machine told to exclude the temp folder.
I see. Well,
it works well
still
for
think it's
but I do tweak it. I do tell it to ignore the podcast folder in iTunes. I tell it to ignore my temp folder. I tell it to ignore a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, that might be part of why it works. I don't know. But
yeah,
I do
so
need
it doesn't
to
get very stressed in my case because it's not actually backing up a lot. It usually takes about 2 or 3 minutes to run.
Oh, that's the other... Oh, backups take me forever. I mean,
that's because you're doing a full clone.
Ever. Well, yeah, but I'm doing an incremental.
But it still has to compare every file.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work. You have a lot of files.
Yeah, I have a crap load of files.
So I do a clone backup once a week, and I use Time Machine in between.
Oh, okay. Hmm. Well, I'll get this figured out about a century from now.
Anyway, back on topic, perhaps.
Oh, back on topic. There's a way we could go.
So after all that, then it comes to uploading it to Flickr. So the first thing I do is I tag all the photographs I do upload to Flickr within Aperture as with the tag Flickr so that I know whether or not they're up there.
Oh,
it
no.
It just be handy.
The tag, that's not a keyword?
Sorry, keyword, yeah.
Oh,
keyword,
okay.
Tag, I consider them interchangeable.
Okay.
The icon for keywords is a tag, so.
Oh, it is, right.
Then the next thing I do is I export them at... I've created my own preset called Flickr, which is 800 pixels maximum dimension at high-quality JPEG.
Oh, yeah, that's good. I like the ability to do that in Aperture. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. So I set up my preset, and I barf them out at that size, and then I run my own custom Perl scripts I've written to stick in shadows, titles, Creative Commons logo, and my URL as appropriate, and then upload them.
Now, what do you... Oh, the Perl program. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the magic gets done.
And that's how the magic gets done. That's everything from clicking the shutter to it's on Flickr.
Wow. That is quite a process. I guess this is sort of like, you know, hey, I sat down at the piano and it didn't sound as good as when you did it.
Hey, Mr. Beethoven, why does yours playing sound so much better than mine?
Exactly. So my process is more like I take some snapshots, I throw away about half as many as I should, and then I push export to Facebook. I definitely get attached to photos. I took a series of photos of my son's friend trying to lift him up, and my son is pushing 6 feet tall, and his friend is not. And it is the funniest series of pictures because you see him succeeding less and less over time. It's not like he's slowly lifting him. He's slowly being crushed by my son. And I kept all those pictures. And it was like 12, and I posted them all.
Yeah, but you see, I take pictures of things and places, and that's different to people.
Right.
Because people, the reason you take a picture of people is because you want to have something to remember them by. And if the picture isn't as perfect as it could be, you don't care because you still get to remember the moment.
Right.
It still evokes that memory. It still lets you relive that scene, or relive that day, or relive that event. Whereas if you're taking a picture of a butterfly and it's all fuzzy and out of focus, you didn't really make friends with the butterfly. It didn't work. Try again next time.
There is that. Oh, well, you know what? This turning the hot and cold stuff on all by itself is the coolest thing ever. While we've been talking, I've just edited all the photos of the recent vacation, getting rid of all the little red and blues. It's really fun to do.
Yeah, and the other thing is then, if you don't have any blues, that black point slider can make such a difference. It could really just make the image so much bolder.
So you're saying if you don't have any blues...
You don't have any blues. Keep pushing the black point slider until you get blues, and then back it off until you just don't.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That can make such a difference.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah. I was just taking a picture that had a lot of gray, but it just became more depth is probably the best way to say it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Well, I have learned a lot, and I hope everybody else has too. It didn't have anything to do with the Mac, but then, it had Aperture in it.
Aperture. A lot of Mac stuff in there.
There you go. But then again, I named my show purposely vague.
That's true, and the chances are you could do all of this in Lightroom.
Oh, I'm sure you can, yeah.
The sliders may have slightly different names and be in slightly different places, but the actual process, the actual adjustments exist everywhere, because they're basic photographic adjustments.
For 50% more money, you could do it.
is Lightroom more expensive?
Yeah, Lightroom is $300 and Aperture is $200 last I checked.
Aperture is worth $200. I wouldn't pay $300 for Lightroom.
Yeah.
I wouldn't pay $300 for Aperture either.
Right. I don't think so. I definitely think it's worth the $200 though. I've just had such good fun with it. And I don't open Photoshop Elements anymore. Just every once in a while there's something I have to do in there.
Yeah, I actually regret almost buying Pixelmator. I thought I'd use it so much, but Aperture does almost everything I need. Especially now that I've discovered the Dodge and Burn plugin. Because I used to do that kind of selective editing in Pixelmator, but now that I'm using the Dodge and Burn plugin, I don't really leave Aperture.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. All right, well, hey, this was more fun than we thought. This was pretty cool.
About photography? It's going to go on forever and ever and ever and a day. I mean,
you said you were feeling drippy at the beginning, and you weren't drippy at all.
Well, my throat is actually killing me at the moment.
Aww. All right. Well,
I have to do IMP Live later, too.
That's right. I was going to say, we better let you rest up for IMP Live, and we'll be talking to you again next week.
We will indeed, but not the week after. But anyway, until next time, happy computing.
Well, it looks like it's time to wrap things up, I'm afraid. Please keep all those great emails coming to allison@podfeet.com. And don't forget to send along those dumb questions, too. And check out the Cafe Press site, cafepress.com/nosillacast, and buy yourself something pretty. Well, remember to follow me on Twitter, too, at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed. And that's the way it is.